Kia ora, everybody. It's nice to see you all here. In this short paper, I hope to say that although humans are the cause of the ecological problem, our fate is linked to that of nature in all its inner workings. Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
We are entangled with all life on Earth because there is no life on Mars, or at least not our life. It is not a real frontier for humans, in spite of Elon Musk. This is our home, as Al Gore, among others, have said. Okay, they're trying to fiddle. There's Mars. Our first hope of healing nature, which is our task, is to know it and pay attention to it in a less objective way. We must therefore be anthropocentric enough to know that humans have a vital role to play still, but not so anthropocentric that we interpret nature only through our human eyes. Losing anthropocentrism is a way to listen or pay attention in a particular way. So, as Pope Francis in Laudato Si has said, modern anthropocentrism has paradoxically ended up prizing technical thought over reality, since the technological mind sees nature as an insensate order, as a cold body of facts, as a mere given, as an object of utility, as raw material to be hammered into useful shape. It views the cosmos similarly, as a mere space into which objects can be thrown with complete indifference. Nature is sometimes cruel and sometimes profoundly beautiful. At times we think we know its laws and can control it. At other times, it confounds us, overwhelms us. We know something of its past, but its future is a source of anxiety. Above all, nature speaks to us in the present of longing and of God. But we exist as humans, always on its edges. Life on this planet has entered the Anthropocene, which just means the geological era, dominated by humans, because we say it has. But we are nevertheless afraid of what that means, unsure whether we are saviours of nature or the cause of its undoing. A few examples. In a stunning case of habitat restoration by the trophic cascade effect, first anticipated and researched by Robert Payne, wolves have been reintroduced to a number of American wilderness areas, including Yellowstone. As a top predator, wolves have kept the elk on the move, which means that they're not eating the leaves so much and the willows are flourishing, and the banks of the rivers have become more stable. Coyotes are under control and badger colonies are flourishing. Similar cascade effects have been felt elsewhere with different intermediate species. It does mean that you have to go hiking and expect to see wolves. Brenda Peterson, the author of Wolf Nation, says the wolf nation must thrive if we are to make the world wild and whole again. Humans have been involved first in the extermination of wolves and then in their reintroduction. But the aim is an ecosystem with minimal human supervision. The speed and diversity of the ecosystem restoration has been surprising even to those who predicted it. And another story, typical of many from around the world, including this country, of cooperation between dolphins and humans. The Aboriginal people of Wurundjeri sat by the sea, or they would sit by the sea, and they would whistle for the dolphins, which would come and start to push the fish toward them. But when the white people came, they learned the whistles and speared the dolphins. Both these stories show how humans can act in close cooperation with and in sympathy with nature. The second is a sort of fall story, a fall from a state of coexistence to a state of enmity with nature. So Wendell Berry says, tellingly, "We have a lot of genuinely concerned people calling upon us to save a world which their language simultaneously reduces to an assemblage of perfectly featureless and dispirited ecosystems, organisms, environments, mechanisms, and the like. It is impossible to prefigure the salvation of the world in the same language by which the world has been dismembered and defaced. Perhaps because nature has so many different faces, and because we sense the ambivalence of the language we often use, Christian theology seems to provide mixed motivation for a lot of environmental action. And recent Christian history is a fallen history. As colonialists and frontier explorers, it was Christian cultures rather than particular Christian humans that would have been among those who denuded the wolves and wounded the dolphins in the first place. Lynn White Jr. picked this up in his article, which we now mark. He did not critique Christianity per se, as Derek said, just what he saw as the current that his 1960s deviant Christian response around him in America of the time, and the historical roots of that reaction. He did recognize that there was a deeper strand of faith that recognizes the attunement of God to nature. The attunement of humans to nature, like that of humans with the dolphins, that sees nature as a path to God, or recognizes the numinous and holy within it. He nominated the Franciscan tradition, very, very far from a complacent, bland 1960s Protestantism, as the answer to this crisis. But I would want to argue here that these strands of deeper response are much wider and more numerous than just the Franciscan tradition. I argue that we need to cultivate some of these deeper responses, perhaps even that we are in many cases doing so. And I will argue that a form of anthropocentrism is both theologically mandated and required for a deeper healing of ourselves and of the earth. Healing requires that we pay attention in a certain way to nature. This might mean reintroducing wolves, but also not hunting wolves. Bruce Fultz, an environmental philosopher who writes on the religious underpinnings of an adequate environmentalism, adds to Francis a litany of writers and theologians who have sensed that nature was a manifestation of God, a place where life itself could be experienced. And these include many Russian philosophers and theologians, including Dostoevsky and Bulgakov, the American nature writers from Emerson and Thoreau, John Muir, to Annie Dillard and Wendell Berry, the English poets Blake and Gerald Manley Hopkins, and many others. We might also think of the 19th century Shakers, a flourishing communitarian movement within America, who believed that they were bringing heaven down to earth in their sparse, beautiful dwellings and tools. We might think of the medieval mystics, Eckhart, Hildegard von Bingen, Julian of Norwich. In this country, both Janet Frame and James K. Baxter used words to plumb the depths of our natures and of nature. Poetry is attendance upon the world, says Janet Frame. The Holy Spirit, you are the fire who does not cease to burn, says Baxter. These writers show us that it is paying attention to nature that is our first and primary religious task of healing. If we are Christians, we want to heal nature, not only to save our planet, and because we love its creatures, but because we sense the shadow of divinity in nature, the breath of the Holy Spirit, the presence of wisdom, if we pay attention in a certain way. So when the wolves and badgers and trees work together again, a divine wound is healed. When the oi or the kiwi return to a neglected mountain forest, God's voice is heard again also. Healing does encode and can lead to all that we call stewardship. Planting trees, tidying up rubbish on the beach, renewing ecosystems, killing rats, thinking of vital and creative responses to the climate change dilemma. These are all essential. But at a deeper level still, and not excluding these, we still find nature confronting us almost as a person, as a demand on us, but also as a gift. Nature resists us, even our attempts to heal it. If we are honest, we will always encounter in nature a depth that escapes an objectification, escapes our attempts to understand it as a machine. Even while our daily lives, its commerce, much of its education, and even our environmentalism speak of it as a machine, as Wendell Berry notes above. This deeper level of knowledge and attention will always be for us both scientific and experiential. The scientific knowledge is especially that which causes wonder, or that which is so embedded in or indwelling of a subject area that the human being knows this aspect of nature through and through. Robert Payne and others who study and understand trophic cascades use science as well as close observation to guide their forms of knowing. What we have learned about intelligence and species as far removed as pigs, elephants, wolves, bees, and trees has been crucial to our renewed respect for them and discussion about their rights. We have come a long way since Jane Goodall was rebuked for giving her gorillas names. We have learned that some anthropomorphism is good because animals are much like us and we can read their faces and gestures because they belong to the same overall communicative structure as ours. Something known already and perhaps more fully by pre-colonial peoples. At the same time, we have also learned that we can still anthropomorphize unwisely and rashly, not acknowledging that deer, elephants, bonobos, dogs, bats, and birds do have their own cultures of signing, and that we can't just rush in and assume to understand. Too much anthropomorphism blurs lines like those between animals that do and don't have a theory of mind. What we have learned of the universe is always stretching our capacity to understand. On the other hand, at some point it is also appropriate to release our need to know and to dominate in order to participate in and with nature, to recognize what Bruce Fultz calls the inner face of nature, the inwardness of nature. Feeling we are in and with nature, understanding at a perceptual level and at an intellectual level that our fates are intertwined and always were. This perceptual level is able to intuit that we still know very little. This is the kind of knowing, Fultz argues, is present in a great deal of Russian theology, philosophy, architecture, and literature. It is also, he claims, evident in sacred scriptures. He notes that the poetics operating at the other end of the Mediterranean, one that had already grasped with much greater clarity the connection between the sense of a unified life of nature and the sensibility for a second side, another side, a third dimension of nature. In the Psalter, that classic anthology of Hebrew poetry and song, is to be found an aesthetic appreciation of the inner life, and indeed inner voice of nature as a whole, that is almost entirely lacking in classical Greek poetry. To the environmentally inclined reader, not deafened by monodic paraphrases of Lynn White Jr., the Psalms can present themselves as containing the first and perhaps greatest collection of nature poetry in the literature of humanity. In these songs, the inner life of nature as a whole emerges with surprising power and beauty. In one litany after another, the entire range of cosmic nature, sun and moon, rocks and hills, mountains, fierce winds and lightning, and crushing waves, serpents and skittering rock badgers, all in concert, sing out in praise, rise up in song, skip and leap and dance, and whirl in joy and anticipation, tremble in awe. Sorry, this is a very long quote. That is, nature presents a face, expresses an inner life, only because it is at the same time disclosed as being turned radically and ecstatically toward a distance unto which all the resonance of that life is directed, and from which that life itself is derived. At the same time, we face a crisis in our dealings with nature. We also sense a deprivation in ourselves, a deep longing for and need for nature. So Charles Taylor, for instance, says, "The sense can easily arise that we are missing something, cut off from something, that we are living behind a screen." And Jacques Ellul says, with technology, the positive effects are easy to articulate and see. The negative aspects are always vague phenomena, which are significant only by their bulk and their general nature, but which eventually give a certain negative style to human life. And Pope Francis, he says, "It can be said that many problems of today's world stem from the tendency, at times unconscious, to make the method and aims of science and technology an epistemological paradigm which shapes the lives of individuals and the workings of society." So the more we use our skills and technology to heal nature, the more we sense also that we are not attuned to nature. We are like friends who don't quite mesh, don't know each other, don't know how to know one another. There is a sense of déjà vu. This is another salvation story, much like the one we have pondered for so long. Is it our own effort or God's efforts that will save us? What does repentance look like vis-a-vis the earth? We vaguely sense that our theologies and worldviews can be a part of the problem still, 50 years after Lynn White Jr. And for Christians, there has always been an iota of worry about affirming God's presence in nature. And I think this is one of the reasons that Lynn White Jr. was correct in pointing to Christianity as a source of the ecological crisis. We might ask, is it idolatry? Is it finding an alternative route to salvation? Is this why Christians have often eschewed nature and developed theologies of escape? Is this why 20th century theology was dominated by Karl Barth, who had these worries exactly? There is a long history, however, of distinguishing between idolatrous worship of nature and nature as a reflection of God's glory. Nature, until very recently, as Fultz suggested, was taken to be a way of entering into God's presence. For one thing, Christian faith allows us to differentiate between God in or contained in nature and God as distinct from matter. Laudato Si, for instance, says, "Judeo-Christian thought demythologized nature. While continuing to admire its grandeur and immensity, it no longer saw nature as divine. In doing so, it emphasizes all the more our human responsibility for nature." Pope Francis goes on to speak about the unique role of humans and the way in which suffering can sometimes draw us into the work of redeeming creation. And the Holy Spirit, who can, as the previous Pope said, loosen the knots of human affairs. But humans exploited or used for ill can in the end be used by God for good. The pains of childbirth, continuing the work of creation, these are some of the phrases used to denote the ongoing work of humans within creation, guided by wisdom and spirit. And this should be taken as a prayerful work. When nature is exploited or betrayed, as the dolphins were, God is grieved. These are difficult balances to maintain. Humans are unique, but find themselves in service to other creatures. All life is journeying towards God in an unknown future, not one that is already mapped out. God is presence and purposeful, but partially hidden, and is not a cause like any other cause. Fultz points to the wisdom of the Byzantine distinction between the divine essence or ousia, eternally hidden and unknowable, even to the celestial order, and the divine energies or energia, immanent throughout creation and noetically presence. The presence or wisdom of God in creation is often experienced as beauty and says faults. I don't think I have this one. It is in beauty that the divine wisdom, the holy wisdom, through which all the cosmos is created and upheld and renewed, is most characteristically experienced. And I suggest that something of this order is an indispensable element for a viable environmental aesthetic. And then again, Pope Francis, echoing St. John of the Cross, says, "This is not because the finite things of this world are really divine, but because the mystic experiences the intimate connection between God and all beings, and thus feels that all things are God. Standing awestruck before a mountain, he or she cannot separate this experience from God, and perceives that the interior awe being lived has to be entrusted to the Lord. Mountains have heights, and they are plentiful, vast, beautiful, graceful, bright, and fragrant. These mountains are what my beloved is to me. Lonely valleys are quiet, pleasant, and shady, and flowing with fresh water. In the variety of their groves and in the sweet song of the birds, they afford abundant recreation and delight to the senses. And in their solitude and silence, they refresh us and give us rest. These valleys are what my beloved is to me," he says. But affirming God in the creation is also mandated by the incarnation itself and by Paul's reflections on that mystery. If we consider Christ, we have every reason to think that nature should be a proper locus for our spiritual attention. Jesus was born of the earth. His healing mandate was present in all he did. He healed humans who were surely going to die in a few decades anyway. He didn't say, "Well, human life is short, so there is no point in healing." Following Jesus and healing are almost identical. If Jesus cured humans who were going to die, he surely also believes in the healing of the earth, the creation, whatever its future. He is the one in whom all of this holds together, the one who turned water into wine, who walked on water, who fed 5,000 with a few loaves and fishes. By faith, we engage in the healing of ourselves and of the earth without knowing how the story will all end. Moreover, Jesus became human and took on matter, took on the second law of thermodynamics, as well as human sin and creaturely suffering. Surely a fool's errand if that was to be followed by no real difference in the long run, in terms of human life and flourishing for nature. So we are told to choose life, and this is that period in which the choosing of life is to choose healing, is to choose God. And lastly, Jesus, in becoming incarnate and in his resurrection into new life, was also blessing and affirming nature. The battle for the human should not take place only in escaping creaturely limits. At the same time, the incarnation affirms that nature is always tinged with transcendence. It's always more than or deeper than what we see on the surface. So incarnation, spirit, wisdom, all require a way of paying attention. Humans are able to pay attention to the world in different ways. One of these ways is efficient and objective, the primary mode of science. The other is more expansive and immediate, more emotionally charged. As we pay attention, we in some senses construct nature, not out of nothing. We're not in a way that is constructing something that isn't there. But nature becomes accessible to us and to our cultures as we pay attention to it and as we name it. We always name the animals that were important to us, that were partners with us in the task of living. That is why the same stuff, nature, can be studied as just the object of our scientific inquiries, and at the same time, it can be considered as holy. The philosopher and psychiatrist McGilchrist speaks of two ways of paying attention. For us as human beings, there are two fundamentally opposed realities two different modes of experience, he says, that each is of ultimate importance in bringing about the recognizably human world, and that their difference is rooted in the bihemispheric structure of the brain. It follows that the hemispheres need to cooperate, but I believe they are in fact involved in a power struggle, and that this explains many aspects of contemporary Western culture. It probably also explains the ecological crisis. Too much of one kind of attention leads to neglect. The kind of attention we pay actually alters the world. He says, we have long known this, but there are different types of construction. The right brain's attention involves a co-creation, a relationship between the knower and the known. The left tends to create from what it already knows, easily becoming a sealed abstraction. A great deal of what is disputed, McGilchrist believes, can be traced back to the two versions or states of affairs we are constantly dealing with in our divided brains. Constantly seeing the world in efficient and objective ways, he says prophetically, we live in an increasingly mechanistic, fragmented, decontextualized world, marked by an unwarranted optimism mixed with paranoia and a feeling of emptiness. The left brain way is essentially human and essential for life. It is only when it becomes dominant that it is a problem, when it crowds out the other forms of knowing. The so-called left-brained way of seeing leads not only to too much reductionism, but to specialization that fails to see the whole. So Laudato Si again. A good part of our genetic code is shared by many living beings. It follows that the fragmentation of knowledge and the isolation of bits of information can actually become a form of ignorance, says the Pope, unless they are integrated into a broader vision of reality. It must be the task of those of us who cherish community and God to be the seeds by which a more holistic way of seeing can emerge. For Francis, this occurs in beauty, especially as seen and discerned in nature. So he says, or indeed when the desire to create and contemplate beauty manages to overcome reductionism through a kind of salvation which occurs in beauty and in those who behold it. An authentic humanity calling for a new synthesis seems to dwell in the midst of our technological culture almost unnoticed, like a mist seeping gently beneath a closed door. Will the promise last in spite of everything, with all that is authentic rising up in stubborn resistance? Thank you.
We have a few minutes for questions. Maybe only about three, but Nicola, do you want to?
Yeah.
Which way am I going?
Yep, you can go first.
Thank you very much for your stimulating lecture. I'm wondering whether you're... obviously, I endorse the poetry side of it, but I'm wondering whether the notion of nature is the one to run with in a theological sense. And I say this for a couple of reasons. One is, nature, as I understand, is a concept of the Enlightenment. It's not a biblical concept. Friends of the earth, the psalmist would understand, but not nature as such. So perhaps a theological rather than a scientific concept, like the use of creation or earth, might be more compatible if you run in a theological argument.
You want me to use different language? Is that right?
Well, I'm thinking about the concept of nature in terms of your main thesis. The other difficulty, there are two other difficulties with nature, is often people talk about what is unnatural, particularly in sexual ethic debates, and it is a difficulty that we make these distinctions, often erroneously, between what is natural or unnatural. But the other contrast is cultural, It seems to me like the eruption of Taupo volcanoes would be natural, but the whole venture of medicine is really beyond the bounds of nature. It's much more a cultural thing now. And so if you take it out of the concept, I'm suggesting that the concept of nature is too narrow, and that in a theological discussion, perhaps another concept like creation or using the earth or the cosmos might be more relevant. What do you think about that?
I have to think about that. I think the thing about creation using the word creation is that it decides the issue ahead of time. Whereas if you're, I would see using nature as a more neutral term in a sense. And yeah. But we can talk about that later. Yeah. Yeah, Paul.
I think perhaps we could have a relationship with nature that, as Martin Buber would say, rather than I it, more I thou. In other words, see nature as being equal to us, not as our possession, a thing, an object.
That's what I'm advocating, yeah. And, I just didn't use that language.
Yeah, and I think that perhaps thinking about it in the framework of I and thou, is a way of perhaps reforming our relationship with nature.
Absolutely, yeah.
Nicola, my high school Latin is inadequate to the task of translating a Laudato Si. Can you tell me what it means?
Jonathan's going to tell us all about it tonight. Yep.
Now, Laudato Si is not Latin. It's medieval Italian, halfway
between Latin and okay.
And it means mayor. By the way, there's an apostrophe after C.
That you're quite right. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, I agree. Sorry.
To replace the missing T.
Yeah. I know. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Always good to end on points of grammar.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Nicola. Really appreciate your talk.